is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, but we're not going to take any callers this hour because we have with us a very, very special guest. In fact, he's not an infrequent guest. In fact, he's getting to be a regular guest here on Radio Liberty. His name is Dr. James Herson. He is a professor of law at Trinity College of Law in Southern California. He's the author of The Coming Collision and Government by Decree and a recent article in the newspaper. We won't have time to talk about that, where he goes into the background of the consideration of international law and what's going on with NATO and Yugoslavia and Kosovo. But right now we're going to be talking about the Declaration of Independence. Dr. Herson, are you there?
I am. It's a pleasure to be a frequent guest on Radio Liberty.
Well, thank you so very much. And we really wanted to get into the background of the Declaration of Independence because certainly this is one of the four major documents, the founding documents of America. And without an understanding of the Declaration of Independence, it's impossible to understand either the Constitution or the Bill of Rights and what our founding fathers were really thinking when they wrote up our Constitution, which became the foundation upon which our republic rests. So why don't you go into the background of the Declaration of Independence? Dr. Herson has certainly come up with a very, very convenient way of remembering this. And for our listeners, we'd like you to get out a pencil and paper and just start writing down what you're going to learn tonight, because this is going to be presented as if it were a class. And so I'm here to learn, and I hope you will be as well. Why don't you pick it up from there?
That's right, and take careful notes because there'll be a test on this.
Right.
No, actually, you know, we're all tested in a way because the Declaration of Independence is sort of the foundation on which our system is based. And one of the things I think that's been lost, it's sort of misunderstood, is how important the Declaration of Independence is really to the whole legal system in America, because it's almost like the birth certificate. In fact, it is the birth certificate of our country. And in that sense, it's very similar to when a company is created, a corporation. It's created through what are called articles of incorporation. And the articles are sort of like the birth certificate. And then the bylaws are the sort of guiding legal principles that spring from those articles. And the bylaws must be interpreted within the framework of the articles. And well into the 20th century in American law, the Declaration of Independence guided the interpretation of the Constitution. And these two documents were viewed as interdependent and really inseparable kinds of documents. And even the Constitution itself, when in Article 7, refers to the date in 1987 as, you know, the year of our Lord, but also refers to the 12th year of independence, referring back to the birth certificate, the Declaration of Independence being adopted by Congress at the time, July 4th, 1776, and when states were admitted to the United States. The State Enabling Acts required the states to commit both to the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. And you can see that in the statutes themselves, particularly for states like Colorado, Nevada, Nebraska, and Oklahoma, the states that came in later. It's interesting, just a little note about Thomas Jefferson, who was the original writer of the Declaration, although it was a collaborative effort. The last words of John Adams, when he died, were, "Thomas Jefferson still survives." And John Adams died on July 4th, 1826, and he wasn't aware of the fact that Jefferson had actually passed away 5 hours before. And Jefferson, earlier that evening had awakened and said, is it the fourth yet? And someone told him yes, and then he sort of went back to sleep and passed away. And it was on the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence and American sovereignty that both of these men passed away on July 4th. It's an amazing anecdote, really.
And, you know, one of the things that nobody had ever commented to me, but, of course, one of my favorite dissertations was the Gettysburg Address. In fact, I gave it in college when I was 16 years old, and my public speaking teacher got up after I'd given the Gettysburg Address and said, I've heard many renditions of the Gettysburg Address during my years as a professor, but that indeed was the worst rendition I've ever heard. But I will never forget, you know, that 67 years ago, our forefathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. And you go back 67 years ago, well, that was the Declaration of Independence that Lincoln was talking about. But you see, we never mention that because, of course, there are so many mentions within the Declaration of God, and those people who would destroy the Christian or Judeo-Christian foundation of this once great nation certainly want to eliminate any reference to the Declaration or to the fact that our freedoms came from God.
Oh, that's so true. And the Founding Fathers, in many of their letters, would refer to the year as, say, the fourth year of the sovereignty of the United States. And that would always relate back to the Declaration of Independence. So it was very clear that our founders thought it was very important. John Quincy Adams said that this was the platform upon which the Constitution of the United States had been erected. He said its virtues, its republican character, consisted in its conformity to the principles proclaimed in the Declaration of Independence. So he's talking about the fact that the Declaration of Independence informs the Constitution. An early Supreme Court case, Gulf Colorado and Santa Fe Railway Company versus Ellis in 1897, described the Constitution as the letter of the law and the Declaration as the spirit of the law, saying, it is always safe to read the letter of the Constitution in the spirit of the Declaration of Independence. And interesting, you know, you talked about our Judeo-Christian and theistic heritage. You know, the Declaration mentions God four times within the document. And the first one is God as the law giver. It calls God when it refers to the laws of nature and of nature's God. And in the second, it talks about God the maker of all things, because it calls God the creator who endowed us with our unalienable rights. And the third reference is to a judge, the supreme judge of the world. And then the fourth is God as a protector, divine providence to whom we look for protection. And that's so important because our Christian heritage is an essential part, really, of understanding historically, culturally, politically, and legally how this country was put together, because it's essential to the understanding. That's why when you refer to that, it being removed from our culture has really removed the understanding, the essence of, you know, the fundamental notions and morals and principles of our country. You know, it was ministers, men of the cloth in the pulpits, that really were laying the groundwork for the spirit that allowed the American Revolution. There was a famous evangelist named George Whitefield who was alive, and during the period between 1736, he died in 1770, he preached 18,000 sermons, and this was during the period called the Great Revival, where Benjamin Franklin noted he would walk down streets of towns and hear hymns coming out of houses everywhere. And there was a spirit of independence because of the way these ministers preached. As a matter of fact, 100 years before there were any tensions between the U.S. and Britain, Charles II, who was the King of England at the time, was warned by his advisors that these American ministers either need to be tamed or regulated or be replaced with Episcopalian priests. And these conflicts, you know, sort of continued under Charles II and James II until William and Mary issued this Declaration of Indulgence in 1689, which brought a sort of a peaceful period. But in 1760, the famous King George III came to power, and he said, you know, we've got to tame these colonies. And so the first thing he did was increase the size of British military and then decide that the colonists would have to pay for it. And various tax acts were passed, and the Townshend Acts, the famous acts, extended taxes beyond just the cost of military, and then finally, most of them were repealed except for dealing with tea, and the famous East Indian Tea Company was excluded from duties while American tea companies were not, which created a very difficult situation economically, and that caused the Boston Tea Party, which resulted in King George shutting down the largest port in America in Boston. And during this period, the media was controlled primarily by forces sympathetic to Britain. And so an alternative media source had to be set up, much like Radio Liberty and much like the Internet.
Like it really was the committees of correspondence, wasn't it?
That's right. Samuel Adams set that up. And what I love is, and I guess today you can't find this in history books, but the slogan for the Committees of Correspondence was, "No King, but King Jesus." Now that's not, I don't think we'll find that in politically correct history books.
And in fact, many of the soldiers used to make that same statement, "No King, but King Jesus."
That's right. And so the historical background is then finally the Second Continental Congress, which was, in fact, the government of the colonies from 1775 to 1788, met in May of 1775. And King George III had not replied to the petition for a number of grievances that had been sent to him from the First Continental Congress. And so in August of 1775, King George basically issued a proclamation that was his version of an executive order saying that American citizens were engaged in open and avowed rebellion. So these tensions just grew. And in May of 1776, the Continental Congress found out that the king was negotiating treaties with the German states to hire mercenaries to fight in the U.S. And so many Americans were starting to get more and more convinced that the colonies were being treated like they were a separate country. And, you know, around that time, a very important work came out from a pamphleteer named Thomas Paine called Common Sense. And it just sold, by the thousands and influenced thoughts very greatly. You know, these are the times that try men's souls. He said, tyranny like hell is not easily conquered. But we have the consolation with us that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. And one of the great things for our time, he said, those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must undergo the fatigue of supporting it. And so things really began to heat up in 1776 in June. And in June 7th, that Continental Congress, having a meeting in Philadelphia, had a delegate from Virginia named Richard Henry Lee, who had a resolution saying, you know, I think it's time for the United States to declare independence. And there were still some delegates that had loyalty to Britain, and so they kind of postponed consideration. But while they did, they decided to appoint a committee to draft a statement that would present to the world the colony's case for independence. And so they appointed two gentlemen from New England, John Adams of Massachusetts and Roger Sherman of Connecticut, and two men from the middle colonies, Benjamin Franklin of Pennsylvania and Robert R. Livingston of New York, and one young Southerner, Thomas Jefferson of Virginia. And, of course, he was the youngest gentleman on the committee, and the elders dished off the work and delegated to him and said, hey, Thomas, you go draft this. Give us a rough draft, which he worked. And he was quite a scholar with a humongous library and very familiar with the philosophy of government of the time, and he put together, he was working for several days and composed a rough draft. And this rough draft was then revised by Adams, and then he gave it to Franklin, who then revised it again, and then all five of them revised. So this was a very much collaborative effort, and before it ever went to Congress, there were 47 alterations and the insertion of three complete paragraphs. And before they voted on it, on independence, the Congress then continued to make changes, so they made another 39 changes, which is one of the reasons it's such a brilliant, incredible document, because these great minds combined and collaborated, and I believe were very much influenced by divine inspiration because of what they came up with, which is such a masterpiece. And they, of course, on July 4th, Congress adopted this declaration, and it was a gentleman named John Dunlap that printed it up. 24 copies are known to exist today, two of which are in the Library of Congress, and one of those was George Washington's personal copy. And so that's really the backdrop of how this amazing document came into existence.
Now, you have divided this up into, what, five separate parts to help people to understand the concepts that are laid out here?
Yes, you know, I was thinking about it. I actually looked over some old notes that I had, and I noticed there was this sort of scholarly designation that was made to the Declaration. I think one was called a preamble, and one was called the, you know, pre-body and the body and all this, and I started looking at it from the point of view of what was Jefferson trying to accomplish with these five sections, and I came up with my own classification, but I said, the first section, really, I called the justification for separation. Actually, it sounds like Jesse Jackson named it. But it states that what the document would do was explain why it was necessary for the American colonies to leave the British Empire. That's the first section. And then the second section talks about the moral and philosophical basis for independence. That's the most important section. It sets out principles that were recognized, that was part of the moral consensus of the world, and explains why it is the right of the citizens and the duty to throw off this government, which is what they're ultimately leading to. And then the third section, and it's very legalistic, but Jefferson was a lawyer, is, I call it, the indictment, because it's giving evidence of this long train of abuses and usurpations that were heaped upon the colonists by King George III. And the fourth section is sort of a required section because they wanted to, these were all former Englishmen, and they wanted to reference their British brethren and let them know that they at least had appealed to them. And that's, I call that the denunciation. And the last section I analogize to, again, a business document, but in a corporation, it's very much like a corporate resolution where a corporation will say, resolved, we hereby seek to acquire another company or something like that. What are we going to do? And so the last section explains, after explaining the justification, the moral basis, the indictment, the denunciation, it explains what has to be done, what action has to be taken. And that, of course, is the independence of a separate state. And we can go through each section in more detail.
Then let's start with the very beginning. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with one another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitles them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. Now, that's the justification, isn't it?
That's right. And it's interesting because it's a paragraph composed of one sentence. And it's an amazing thing looking at this because of the collaborative effort. It's just everything about it, every word really has significance. And the opening phrase sets the American Revolution in this big panorama. It says that it's in the course of human events, that this is not some trifling matter. This is a serious matter. And the laws of nature and of nature's God really refers to this wonderful, it's more than a philosophy, it's the truth, that notion that law is really just a shadow of something that is universal called natural law or the laws of nature that comes from God, that through reason we can in fact realize the universal notion of right and wrong. So the laws of nature refer to natural law, and of nature's God is those laws that are revelation, that really refers to the Bible, to divine revelation, that this combination of laws of nature, which, by the way, both of those concepts are referred to in Paul's epistle to the Romans. He refers to a law that can be determined through reason, and, of course, the revelation law of the Scriptures. But both of these entitle America to a separate and equal station among the powers of the earth. And this sanction from the opinions of mankind, the introduction dignifies the revolution as something that involves principle, and it proclaims that a moral legitimacy, and it never mentions England or America by name. So it's an amazing thing. And also the word necessary in 18th century language had a kind of a tone of involving deterministic overtones, almost a destiny, divine destiny, that this is something that is separate and distinct from or beyond the control of human agents. And then what's very important is in that justification section, it calls one people, which is Americans, and another, which is British. So it reinforces the idea that breaking the political bands between these two people, that they're two distinct groups, and helps to set in motion the tone that this is already really a separate nation, that we're not talking about a civil war, because this was the most powerful military in the world that we potentially were taking on as America, and it would be very helpful if we could receive assistance, perhaps from France or from other foreign sources, and it would be less likely to get that assistance if it was viewed as a civil war. In other words, within a sovereign nation as opposed to two sovereign nations. And also defining Americans as a separate people helped under 18th century philosophy to justify the idea of the revolution, because if American Great Britain were looked upon as one people, Congress itself would have difficulty justifying revolution, because obviously a significant portion of the citizenry, the British citizens, would have been against it. But in looking at them as separate people, if we had the American support, Congress could justify it.
And then, of course, wasn't there a great deal of writing at that time, for instance, John Locke, these ideas of the laws of nature and nature's God, and Blackstone in his commentaries on the laws of England, and Samuel Rutherford, who had written about all men being created equal, and Montesquieu, and all of these were basically Christian writers talking about man's right to be free. And wasn't it really this Christian concept of the fact that we should be ruled by God and not by government that really led up to them making this break with England?
There's no doubt about it. I mean, there are so many quotes from early Americans. There's one by Patrick Henry that said that the nation was founded by Christians on the gospel of Jesus Christ. I mean, there's so much of the Reformed Christian tradition inherent in this philosophy. And you mentioned Blackstone's commentaries. Blackstone's commentaries were almost the sole book that lawyers used in law school and judges used to determine you know, rights and liabilities in just normal civil and criminal matters. And it was the Bible of lawyers in essence. And Blackstone's commentaries is soundly based on biblical concepts. It has all kinds of references to scripture. And, yeah, there's absolutely no doubt that influences this section, and even more so, the next section that we're going to go to.
All right, why don't we get to that? Because the next section, I think, is so vitally important.
And I call that the moral basis for independence, or the philosophical basis.
Okay, now, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, and that whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute a new government laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness.
See, I think your teacher was wrong. I think you do a wonderful job.
Well, that was a long time ago. I was 16 years old. I was the youngest boy in the class, and most of the people there were maybe 23, 24. It was during the Second World War, and all these pretty co-eds were there, and I was trying to be very impressive, and I did a terrible, terrible job. I'm sure my professor was right. But it gave me an incentive to try to do better and to learn how to talk. And so I really do owe him a tremendous debt of gratitude.
So we'll have to thank him for Radio Liberty. Maybe I wouldn't be here. And, you know, and this is the closest thing I can think of is this is it's like a Beethoven symphony. It's people say when they listen to Beethoven's music that it's inevitable, that you wouldn't change one note. And that's what it seems like, and particularly in this section. This is five sentences, 202 words altogether, and, you know, you mentioned John Locke. He wrote a treatise, the Second Treatise of Government, which influenced Jefferson and the others very much, but they were able to really distill and compress the complex ideas of John Locke really into this wonderful, incredible paragraph, and so many things are in here. One of the things that's important is that just the first words that say, we hold these truths to be self-evident. You know, what could be a greater contrast from today's relativism that, in fact, this document believes in truth, that there is such a thing as absolute truth that can be, in fact, self-evident, that even to believe in truth, especially today when we live in such an age of deceit. It appears as though our modern culture does not embrace truth. And then, of course, the other thing is there's these two pillars that the American system is built on. And this answers two fundamental questions. And the questions are these. Where do our rights come from? And secondly, where does government get its power? And here it answers that. It says that we are endowed by our Creator with these unalienable rights, that rights are implanted in us. They're inherent in us. They come from a divine source. And the second question, where does government get its power? Well, they get their power from us, from the consent of the governed. And those two things are what our system is built on, limited government, the idea that through the social contract that we named the Constitution, that the federal government gets only that power which we specifically state in the document, and no more. And therefore, we have the rights, and we benevolently give some of it to the government, and those rights do not come from the state. Now, that's in great contrast, of course, to the philosophy of the United Nations and the philosophy that we see reflected in treaties and international documents, et cetera.
All right, we're going to have to take a quick break here, and when we get back, Dr. Herson will get into this second part, the moral philosophy behind the Declaration of Independence.